Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy, and I've changed course on something. Look, I'm a purist, and as such, I got all offended a few years ago when the PGA Tour made, in my opinion, a concerted effort to make the TPC the fifth major. Look, I know the LPGA has five. Shoot, I think the PGA Tour champions may have six at this point, but the PGA Tour has four. And the four have remained unchanged for almost a century, and there's no need to do anything with them or to add to them. As a result of this, I came to loathe this tournament and its course. Well, like a fine wine, I've mellowed with age. I think they finally tweaked the course enough that I really appreciate some of the nuances of it. And there's no question that with last week and this, you have the best three-hole finishes of any courses on tour. I still think the Island 17th gets a little too much hype. To me, it's not even the most famous par 3 in America, but I can live with that. They've played this tournament at the same site since 1982. In that time, five people have won it twice, no one three times, and no one has defended his title. That is a testament to a great track and a top-notch field. We'll talk TPC with John McGinnis of PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM. Also, Chris Rodell has written a new book on Arnold Palmer, but this one is unique. It solely focuses on Arnie's life in his beloved Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And the University of North Carolina men's golf team heads to regionals in Kissimmee, Florida next week, and we will preview that with head coach Andrew DiBattista. But we begin with the one and only John McGinnis. John, let's start off, put a bow on what we saw last week. You've been around, you've seen old quail, you've seen new quail. What's your current assessment of the course in the tournament?
Well, I mean, I love the golf tournament. It's, you know, one of those events that the players look forward to. I don't know that there's too many towns that greet the players any better or treat the players any better than Charlotte. Now, as far as the golf course, I'll be honest with you, I liked it better before. I think 16 is a fabulous hole. I love the change there. 17 was hard enough at 210, if you ask me, with an awkward angle over there on the right-hand side, and I don't like any of the changes on the front. Having said all that, I still love it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I saw the changes, of course, for the PGA last year, but I wanted to see how they played. You know, instead of gnarly Bermuda rough and the ride that looks a lot meaner than it is and, you know, the cooler temperatures and just a normal tour setup, I wanted to see how it played. And I can remember, you know, that championship, you know, you on the front nine, there were two or three places where you had to go out and get birdie. You needed to be two under or so before you headed to the back nine. And John, it seems to me like now they're holding on for dear life until they get to seven.
Yeah, I agree. And when you tee off 10, you play, you know, the first six holes are fine, and then you have nine consecutive just brutal holes, and then obviously a softer finish. So it's, you get the nine easy holes in the middle of the golf course when you tee off one, and by easy, they're not real easy. So yes, it's an awkward, that first hole is a terrible mistake. You know.
Now don't hold back.
I mean, it's just, I understand. It's just brutal. And you know, these guys can hit drivers 7-iron, and it's not brutal for them. I just can't imagine that the members like it, even as a par 5.
John McGinnis with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM is our guest taking dead aim. Did it surprise you with it being such a bomber's ballpark that we didn't see DJ or Rahm here last week?
You mean just in attendance?
Yeah, just playing.
You know, I never question players on their schedule. You know, they know what they're doing. And if they don't, they'll figure it out pretty quickly. It's, you know, their prerogative where they play. I'd love to see them every week, but you understand why they can't be there.
Absolutely.
You know, I would have thought Jordan Spieth would be there too, but, you know, he has a big stretch coming up after the Players with back-to-back tournaments in Texas.
Right. John, next year this tournament is likely to be either a week or 2 weeks before the PGA when it moves to May. Which is a better spot, do you think, the week before or 2 weeks out?
That's a tough question. Looking at next year's schedule, which it doesn't exist yet,
yes.
There's just too many question marks for us to start answering anything definitively. The tour was supposed to release the schedule for next year this week. There's been interest from Minneapolis. There's been interest from Detroit. You know, we know that Bridgestone is gone, but that Memphis is going to become a WGC. We know that everything's going to get moved back in terms of the playoffs and that the PGA is moving to May. So there's just way too many moving parts to be able to say. I think that Mr. Harris, Wells Fargo, and Quail Hollow are always going to draw a top field no matter what.
John McGinnis with PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk this week. It's TPC week. It moved to the Players Course, the tournament Players Course at Sawgrass in 1982. Since then, there's only been five players that have won it twice. No one has won it back-to-back. And I bring this up because, sort of like Augusta National, they play this course every year in these conditions, every year since it moved to May. Does it surprise you that someone hasn't won it three or four times, or is it just that tough?
I just think that it's Pete Dye. It's Pete Dye's masterpiece. And the margin between great and awful is often 6 inches on a Pete Dye course. And I hate to say luck is a big factor, but luck is a big factor. Where your good shots end up is a big factor in how you play this week. Because on the Pete Dye course, all good shots don't end up where they're supposed to. Sometimes they end up in pot bunkers. Sometimes they end up in lakes. So, no, it doesn't surprise me. When players finish this golf course with a smile on their face, that surprises me.
The 18th at TPC is not unlike the 18th at Memphis, is not unlike the 18th at Houston. There's a big, huge body of aqua on the left. Why is it that water on the left scares touring professionals more than any other place? You see guys bombing it way outright at all three of those places to avoid it, whereas if the water's on the right, it never seems to bother them.
That's an interesting point. Obviously, drawers are turning it toward it. But as a fader who played the tour for years and stood on most of those tees and never played at the current golf course in Houston, aiming at the water is no fun. And aiming at the water, hitting a 10-yard cut is very uncomfortable. So oftentimes, on like 18 at Memphis, I would hit 3-wood and leave myself a 5-iron in just to get it in the fairway. So, yeah, you're right. Water on the left is it's a nemesis for the best players in the world.
Tiger Woods played here last week. He's in the field again this week. I think this will be his 8th tournament. Are we, and by we I mean the media, are we expecting too much of Tiger? Is Tiger expecting too much of himself? Or is it fair to even make a judgment 7 or 8 weeks into this?
I think he's starting to make judgments. I walked with him on Friday doing the PGA Tour live coverage, and that was the worst I'd ever seen him putt. Now, it's not the worst he's ever putted historically, but it was the worst that I had seen. And I've seen a lot walking with Tiger over the years and playing with him in the early part of his career. I don't think it's too early. I think that, you know, this is the story every week, and he's going to figure the putting out. I'm very curious to see where he measures up when he puts it all together. You know, if he plays his best golf, does that beat these kids? I think it does, and I think he thinks it does, and I think a lot of them think it does. But we're going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about walking with him on Friday. I saw a lot of him, his play last week out here up close and personal. And I think his ball striking is really good. It's as good as anybody else who's out there right now in terms of that we're not seeing the big, enormous misses that we saw before he got, you know, before he left this last time. His misses are not too far off. His dispersion is really good. And, you know, the show that he puts on the driving range is nothing short of spectacular. So I was like you. I was really kind of surprised that, you know, he putted like me. It was very strange to see Tiger Woods missing on the low side of a hole ever, and he was missing short and on the low side all weekend.
Here's the way I think it played out, and I'm just guessing because I don't know. But remember, Tiger and TaylorMade built those irons that he's playing with. Those are not something that are on a shelf. So they spent some time, and then he hit a lot of balls trying to get it right. Well, what happens to your putting when you get a new set of irons? You go to the driving range, you hit those irons, and you love them. But you forget about your putting because it's so much fun to hit the new irons. And I think Tiger did that a little bit. I think, you know, when he was able to move after the surgery, he could putt first. And so he putted, and he putted. And when he came back, he was putting great. And then not so much now. So He'll figure out what works for him. This is a new routine, you know, he can't go at it full bore all the time now. So he's figuring out what works best for him. And I'm not worried about him figuring that part of it out.
Are you insinuating that Tiger Woods may be becoming mortal?
I've seen way too much to suggest that.
John McGinnis is with PGA Tour Radio on Sirius XM. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. This weekend, we're going to be a month out from the U.S. Open. Of the big names in the field this week, who do you has the most to prove or improve between now and then?
Ooh, really good question. Jordan Spieth, I think.
I think so, too. Not to prove.
I think he and Rory, who are suffering from the same thing Tigers. They're just not making any putts. You know, those are the guys that we expect to be there. Other than that, you know, DJ's the number one player in the world still, and he's certainly not playing like it. I'm interested to see how Shinnecock plays. The fairways are supposed to be quite a bit wider than we've ever seen them there. With some funky angles. So I think that it's going to take a bit of a mad scientist to figure it out. And the two guys that figured out Chambers Bay, the best were Spieth and DJ. So those are my picks for guys who have a lot to prove and guys who have the ability to do it.
Get you out of here on this, John. This tournament has a way sometimes, like last year, of all of a sudden the Siwoo Kims of the world popping up and winning it, the Craig Perks of the world winning it, as often as you have the Davis Loves, the Tiger Woods, the Phil Mickelsons winning it. That being said, you're a betting man. Who you got?
You know, this is going to make the folks in that area happy. I think, and I'm not saying he's going to win, but I think Harold Varner III is going to have a great week. Coming off making the cut in Charlotte, which is big when, you know, you're local. And he played a practice round with Tiger on Tuesday. That matters. You know, there's some confidence to be gained there. And with Harold, it's all about confidence. So I'm very curious to see how he'll play this week. Other than that, Europeans seem to play this golf course really well. Henrik Stenson leading the tour or in the top two in driving accuracy. That matters here. So Henrik Stenson is another good pick.
Do you think that maybe Europeans play that course better because they, just in the way they're brought up, and I'm speaking of courses in the open rota, they play the game so much closer to the ground anyway, and so they're not as affected by the weird bounces and things that happen on a Pete Dye kind of golf course than we are?
Well, I think certainly around the greens. Once they miss the green, they're a lot more comfortable hitting those little bump shots than the Americans are. You want to mess up a European player put them in 3 inches of Bermuda rough, two steps off the green. They don't have any idea what to do. But you put them 5 steps off the green on a closely mown area, like we had around Quail Hollow last week, and they're magicians. So I think that's part of the reason right there.
Hear him, his unique style, and frank opinions from the TPC all weekend long on PGA Tour Radio. That's John McGinnis. And when we return, golf writer Chris Rodell takes dead aim at the king, Arnold Palmer, with a look at his life that most don't know. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. In 1992, golf writer Chris Rodell moved to Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and over the next 20-plus years, became more than acquainted with one Arnold Daniel Palmer. His new book, Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King, all about Palmer's life in Latrobe, and we had the chance to speak earlier this week. Chris, before we dive into your book about Arnold Palmer, as a current resident of Latrobe, Pennsylvania, you have to answer a question for me that I've been dying to know for years.
Yes.
Fred Rogers was born in March of 1928. Arnold Palmer was born in September of 1929, both in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. So they're within a year class-wise of each other. You can make an argument that no two people from one place in the world have done more for children than Arnold Palmer and Fred Rogers.
Yet
I never come across anything that has them working together on a project or being involved charitably together. Am I wrong, or did they really not have an involvement, even though they were so charitable, both of them?
That's a great point. You know, searching my memory now, I can't recall any incident of that either. I do remember that Mr. Palmer was so competitive when I told him that Fred Rogers had won the Congressional Medal of Freedom prior to him. He seemed a little miffed.
Oh, my God.
He's the only guy in the world that would be competitive with Fred Rogers.
Oh, my God. That's a fantastic story. You know, Arnold is synonymous with Latrobe. Are there any shrines or anything to Mr. Rogers there? Just wondering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a statue downtown and McFeely Rogers Park. So he's well represented and very beloved for all the same reasons as Mr. Palmer.
I've just always been curious about that, and I was searching and searching this morning to find a common cause in Latrobe or something that they worked together on. I couldn't even find a picture of them together.
No, I've seen one picture of them together, but they really didn't have that much to do with one another. It wasn't any hostility or anything. They were friendly, but their paths never crossed. I think part of it might have been that they were both two successful people working their own ways.
Oh, yeah, they were completely different personality-wise and field and everything else. I mean, I get that.
Yeah, so they didn't need to overlap to help the town. But that's a very good question. I'll have to talk to some people about that.
Chris Rodell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the things that caught my eye immediately was a golf writer or someone who has written at the time in the world of golf in 1992 moves to Latrobe, Pennsylvania and does not start pestering Arnold Palmer. Did that raise more red flags than if you did go to pester Arnold Palmer?
No, they were very happy about that. They did not like being pestered. And I would show up there. I was doing those Amazing But True golf calendars, you know, those page-a-day things you tear off.
Loved them.
Yeah, and so did Arnold Palmer. He was like my number one fan. And I would drop them off at Christmas, one for Doc Giffen and one for Mr. Palmer. And then I would leave them alone. And eventually Doc called me up to golf, and we still didn't have a real breakthrough chumminess-wise until we got to the bar. And he said, Chris, what'll you have? And he's very austere and very proper. I said, I'll have a double Jack Daniels on the rocks, no straw. And he put his arm around me and said, my man! That was my bourbon order.
You brought up a great name, Doc Giffen. Explain to people exactly who Doc Giffen was and who Doc Giffen is.
Well, first of all, he's a man that if anybody has the audacity to write a book about Arnold Palmer, it should be Doc Giffen. But he promised him years ago he'd never write a book and never betray any secrets like that. I never made that promise, and I said that I was lucky enough to be part of the solar system, but I was like Pluto, and people argue whether Pluto's even a planet. Doc Giffen is Earth. If Arnold was the sun, Doc Giffen was Earth. He was there for 50 years, and I have such high regard for the man, And I really said to my wife, I said, I go, this is could be dangerous. I said, if Doc doesn't like this book, we're going to have to leave town.
How is Doc now? I would have thought that even more than family almost, he was closer than a brother to Arnold Palmer. I would have thought that Arnold's loss, both professionally and personally, would have been so devastating that it would have been hard for Doc to bounce back. How is he doing now? What is he doing?
He's doing great. You know, I still see him for lunch once in a while, and Doc and I are both fans of Survivor, which struck me as very odd that he likes Survivor like I do. But we always get together and talk about Survivor on Thursday afternoons, and he's doing good. I think the reason that it didn't devastate him was because he had such a great relationship with him for so many years that he'd done everything he could, you know, that there was nothing left in the tank, and he lost his friend, and he was devastated by that, but he moves on. But I'm glad you bring him up. You know, he's just a great man. I'm very fond of him. When, a lot of times when people would say, what's it like to work with a legend, I would go right to Doc Giffen and say, Doc Giffen is great to work with.
I've been around celebrities in the music business and in the movie and TV business and in the athletic arenas for the better part of 20 or 30 years. And I have seen a lot of people who were very famous and very successful who were very uncomfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
I don't think, maybe with the exception of Garth Brooks,
yeah, that's a good analogy.
I have ever met anyone who enjoyed being who they were more than Arnold Palmer enjoyed being Arnold Palmer. Do you think that's a fair statement, that no one loved being who they were more than him?
Yeah, that's a great point. He never ducked from celebrity, you know, that people would come up and see him in the streets and say, there's Arnold Palmer. He never minded taking pictures with people, and that he reveled in being who he was, and he was just so happy. There's a story that one of the women who worked at the halfway house said 2 weeks before he died, he was sitting out in his golf cart on number 10 hole by himself, and it was twilight, and she said she looked at him, and he had just had this smile on his face. He was all by himself looking around at the trees and the golf course that he had built and maintained for all these years, and she said he just looked so at peace with himself, and that's an image I like to have of him, that he was, you know, toward the end of his life, 2 weeks away, in fact, and he just was so content with all he'd done. And he was really a great man. We really miss him still every day.
Chris Riddell is the author of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. The entire focus of your book is Arnold Palmer and his life in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. I know he spent several months a year, you know, down at Bay Hill, but the majority of the time he loved to live right there, just a few hundred yards from where he grew up in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And I would think on the surface, for those that don't know, and this may get back to the point of Arnold being so comfortable in his own skin, that one would think someone that famous, that they would want to stay close to home because it would give them a sense of being grounded, and they would feel like no one would ask anything of them. And on the surface, maybe, but Arnold Palmer, I almost get the idea, he would have been offended if he didn't have things asked of him, if the Rotary Club didn't come to him and ask for a donation for the high school, if those things didn't happen, that would have bothered Arnold more, right?
Oh, that's a good point. You know, he was happy to help these community organizations, and he had the means to do it. And the one reverend that said, after he passed away, he said, he goes, what we're going to miss most is he always cut the check. You know, you would go up and ask him to help you out, and he would always sign a check, some donation. There's a story about a shop with a cop that the state police do to help with kids. And he thought he would get $5,000 from Mr. Palmer, and he ended up getting $50,000. And he said, Mr. Palmer, can I release this to the public and let the papers know? And he said, no, let's just keep that between you and me. But he completely funded the program for 5 years out, and it's self-sustaining, and nobody knew about it.
How many stories like that did you come across? Of all the things we know about Arnold, and they are well documented, all you need to do is look at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Children in Orlando, yeah. And there's hospitals all over the country that show his magnanimous charity. But how many of the stories like that with the shop with the cop did you find? The stories that no one knows.
I thought I knew him pretty well. I interviewed him over 100 times over 20 years, studied him, knew people that knew him, But until I sat down and got to talk to the people that helped me write this book, I didn't know him the way I thought I did. He was incredibly generous and incredibly giving of his time. And, you know, he would the most important person in the world was the person that was right in front of him. He would talk to that person. There's a great story that Sam Saunders told at the memorial. He called him up, and Mr. Palmer answered the phone. He said, "Where are you? Or who are you talking to?" He said, "I'm talking to the president." And Sam said, "The president of what?" And he said, "The president of the United States." He goes, "Why did you answer the phone in the Oval Office?" He said, "Because I wanted to talk to you." You know, he just had a great appreciation of one-on-one human relationships.
I'm glad you brought up the memorial service. You were there. You were in the cathedral when that was going on.
Yeah.
And you brought up something else, and I thought of this, and I spoke with my son about it last weekend when we bumped into Jim Nance here at Quail Hollow. Jim Nance is great at what he does.
Yes.
His best moment, and you mentioned this in the book, his best moment, in my opinion, that he's ever had were the 15 minutes that he spent in front of that group at Arnold Palmer's memorial service.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
All I could think was, not only is this wonderful, but selfishly I'm thinking, whoever's got to follow Jim Nance, they need just to just walk up there and say, "I loved Arnold," and walk off. Because you're going to just pale by comparison. Look, I was bawling like a baby in my living room. There couldn't have been a dry eye in the house.
Yeah. Nance said he was more nervous about that than any of the Super Bowls he's ever done.
Look, to me, and I realize I'm a golfer, but to a lot of people in the world, I mean, this was a man who dined with queens and dined with people in pool halls. It was a more important audience and a wider audience than he may have ever had for a Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah, probably. Tom Ridge said that, and Tom Ridge is the former governor of U.S., a Vietnam veteran, and the Department of Secretary of Homeland Defense. He said it was the greatest memorial he's ever been to. He said that it should be taken and shown in schools on how to memorialize someone and who deserves that kind of memorial. I said I think it would be better as a Broadway play.
It was incredibly moving. It really was. And having been around Vince Gill for the last 25 years, and you brought up him, Vince Gill was exactly who Vince Gill is, and just so on point. Chris Rodell has written a book called Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about some of the fun stuff in the book. Talk to me about Arnold's dog and the tennis ball.
Well, that was one of the first times I interviewed him, and I was very nervous. I still had this reverence for him. And that was the time I was able to understand how to connect with him on a juvenile level that he enjoyed. Well, I was up there, and he was signing autographs, and he spent 3 hours every day signing autographs from people from all over the world and sending them back. And I was doing a story about golfers and their dogs, and I said, "What's an old rule stickler like you doing with a dog named Mulligan?" And he said, "You know, there's nothing wrong with a Mulligan. We have that's our rule here at the club. You're allowed to take a Mulligan on the first tee." I said, "Is he a good on-course dog?" He said, "No, he's lousy. He chases after balls and slobbers them up." He said, "It's probably because I spend an hour every day out here hitting a tennis ball with a wedge into the net, and he chases after him." And I just thought, I go, man, would that be special. I said, "I'd like to see that." And he put his pen down. He got a gleam in his eye, and he said, "Come on." And it was like we were playing hooky, you know, just like you were running away from school. His duties were over. And he was sitting there, and then during that next 25 minutes or so, we just bantered. You know, we talked sports, we talked politics, and I just thought, this is my moment. You know, I can say that I had this time with Arnold Palmer. Little did I know I'd be fortunate enough to spend many, many hours like that with him later, but that was a special moment to watch him with a pitching wedge hitting a tennis ball and watching this dog soar after it in his backyard.
Chris, I was thinking about a meeting that I had with a radio station owner that I was working for when I was 22 years old, and he took me out to eat to Steak and Ale, and I thought, wow, this is the nicest place I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
And he ordered a steaks, and he ordered me a bourbon, and he ordered me a glass of red wine. And he sat them both in front of me, and I thought, okay, this is really, really odd. And he told me something. He said, "Son, you need to be as comfortable in the boardroom with this high-dollar wine as you are in the back room with this whiskey."
Yeah.
And I don't think I can think of anyone in sports who better epitomized being comfortable in both worlds and being equally accepted in both worlds as Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, the working title of the book for a long time was One Part Champagne, Three Parts Beer. Because people were asking me, you know, how was I feeling when he died? And I said, I feel one part despair, three parts euphoria. Despair because he's gone, euphoria because I got to spend time with him. And that is all a play on the Arnold Palmer tea, which is one part lemonade, three parts tea. But I said, Arnold Palmer, the man, was like Latrobe. He was one part champagne, three parts beer. You can have that range of socialization. You can literally have drinks with the Queen on one night, and then the next night be at the town hall, fire hall, drinking with the guys down there.
You mentioned dining with the Queen or perhaps having a beer at the Tin Lizzy. This is a man who was a member at Augusta National, could get on any golf course in the world he wanted at a moment's notice with a snap of his fingers. Yet you called him a lazy golfer, and I love this. It wasn't about his work ethic or his habits. It was that he was just as happy walking across the street to Latrobe Country Club.
Yeah, that always irritated me. I said, if I had his means, I would be at Pebble Beach on Monday. I would be at Augusta on Tuesday. I would be at all these places. I'd never be home. And I said to him, I said, you know, you could play Laurel Valley right down the street, 15 minutes. You could play Oakmont. It's an hour away. Or if you wanted, you could get in your plane, fly to Augusta, and be back by dinner. I said, why do you play Latrobe day after day? He said, it's just so close. And I love that. You know, there's no pretension about him at all. I marched it off. It was 1,987 paces from his front door. And I swear, if there was a course that was 1,986 paces from his front door, he'd play that instead.
One of the great questions you can ask someone of Arnold Palmer's success in the game of golf is, when was the last time you paid for blank? In other words, when was the last time you paid for golf balls? When was the last time you bought a golf club? When was the last time you paid greens fees? And I love this story the most, because the last time someone made Arnold pay greens fees was it's one of the bucket list courses in America, and he never went back.
Yeah, it was Bandon Dunes. And they went out there to play. They'd heard so much about it. I've never played it either. And he heard so much about it. And they went to the clubhouse, and they said, that'll be $100, Mr. Palmer. And he was very surprised. And I speculated he paid less than any man on earth to play that much golf, because his father was a green superintendent, so he played free then. In college, he played free, and then in the service, and then as a professional. And they said that became like a tagline out there, that they even charge Arnold Palmer out there. But he said he'd never go back.
Chris Rodell has written a book, Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. You spent many, many hours talking with Arnold Palmer. Part one of the question, did you ever have a point in all of those years when you were sitting there that you forgot that you were talking to one of the most famous people on the planet and in the game, and it was just some guy you knew, or were you always aware?
No, it would drift in and out. You know, like I was raised by the son of one of these Arnie's Army guys that just absolutely revered him. And so I carried that with me, that I had my father as a ghost haunting me, saying, don't you screw this up, don't offend Mr. Palmer. But then there's the line I use that I can't really say on the radio. I said, I just want you to know how much I enjoy hearing your insights, Mr. Palmer. And he said, I enjoy you coming in here and blowing so much sweet smoke. And he said a description of where the smoke went. And I thought, man, this guy's just like my buddies at the bar down the street. And he is so much a Latrobe guy. And the one of the things I love about him, he was worth about $800 million when he died. And he would have been treated just the same as if he was worth $800 in this town. People wouldn't have treated him any differently. They'd have been still happy to see this joyful, cheerful, determined, bold man walk into the bar. Arnie's here. And that's the way it was, no matter what he was worth.
Outside of any recordings you have of interview sessions or any notes you have from interview sessions, is there something that you have, a memento, if you will, of the times that you spent with Arnold Palmer that means more to you than any other?
Well, I just got one, in fact, posthumously. A week ago. Prior to that, it was a picture of me interviewing him with Doc in the background. These interviews were just so much fun, so much bantering. And I remember Doc said after Mr. Palmer had passed, he goes, well, I guess that's all done for. And I said, no, I have an idea. Seance. But we didn't go that far. But just recently, somebody gave me the hat and the golf glove that was on his cart. since the last time he drove it. And that hat, to put that on my head, they said how much they liked the book and they wanted me to have this, and I was just thrilled with it. You know, I don't know whether I want to wear it or preserve it in a museum-type display, but I was very touched by that, to have that last hat that Arnold Palmer wore on a golf course.
The book is Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King, a great Father's Day gift idea, by the way. The author, Chris Rodell. And up next, the University of North Carolina men's golf team is headed to regionals, and head coach Andrew DiBattista takes dead aim at his seniors, his conference, and what to expect next week in Kissimmee, Florida. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park, and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. The University of North Carolina Tar Heel men's golf team is on their way to Kissimmee, Florida for regionals next week. And before the team left, I had the chance to catch up with head coach Andrew DiBattista. Coach, I want to start with Carter Jenkins. I ran into Carter, didn't get a chance to talk to him last week, but ran into him because he Monday qualified here at Quail Hollow. I know that he's been playing up on the Canadian Tour. How is Carter? Have you talked to him lately? How's his career going?
Yeah, he was actually, it was interesting. He was out here literally the weekend right before the Monday qualifier. He was out on our range talking to our guys. I spoke with him. He was actually kind of talking to the guys about the process that he's been going through and how he's been chasing Mondays, and just, you know, he feels good about his game. And, I mean, really just about the difficulties of what he's trying to do and chase the Mondays. You could play phenomenal golf and keep shooting 67, 68, 67, even 66, and sometimes it isn't enough. But obviously we're all very happy for him and glad that he broke through. I think he was co-medalist, for the Monday qualifier. And I know he, you know, certainly would have liked to play better in the actual event. Kind of one door opens another, and he got some really good news this week and got another, exemption, sponsor exemption into the Rex Hospital. So he'll be competing on the web.com here in just a couple weeks, very close to home.
That's fantastic. Andrew DiBattista is our guest taking Dead Aim. He, of course, the head coach of the University of North Carolina Tar Heels. We'll get to what happened in the ACC tournament and preview the regional momentarily. But I've been interested to follow, and I like to pull back the curtain on college golf a little bit whenever I can, because your season and your activities are so different than other sports. For example, when a football team qualifies for a bowl game, they get into, you know, most of the time finals are over with, they get into pretty intensive practice sessions and they're working. It's like a normal everyday thing. Let me sort of tell you what the University of North Carolina did in between the conference tournament and the regionals. They had finals. And then yesterday, I'm talking with you on the phone, and you're following your guys as they're trying to qualify for the U.S. Open. You got some here, you got some there. The activities are just, it's kind of weird. I mean, I guess they'd be playing golf anyway, so why not try to qualify for the Open?
Yeah. No, it's a sport where you're busy year round. Even our college season, so many sports are a fall sport or a winter sport or a spring sport. And I guess technically the NCAA determines or, deems us to be a spring sport. But, obviously we go year round. The college season is obviously from about August until, the last week of May, first week of June. But our guys stay busy in the winter. They stay busy in the summer. This is a really busy time. You get done with the ACC championship, and as soon as you get back, our guys get hit with final exams. And the other thing to keep in mind too is, freshmen have to move out of dorms. Some of the upperclassmen maybe have to move from an apartment to a house or an apartment to a different apartment. And then you throw in U.S. Open qualifying. So we had four guys going yesterday. We got Jose, who's playing his practice round right now. He has his qualifier tomorrow, and we got a group of guys that are flying down to regionals tonight, and I'll be hanging back and waiting for Jose, and then we'll go down tomorrow and catch up with everybody.
I love that, and that's just standard operating procedure for golfers, and it's not out of the ordinary for y'all to go down separately. But one thing that I love about college golf and your program in particular, because I've gotten to know you over the years, and this, when I saw pictures of this last night, this is so you. There's lots of team dinners that take place in fancy restaurants in celebration of wins, and that's the same across the board, no matter what the sport is. But the relationship between the college golf coach and the 8 to 10 guys that are on his team, I think, is very, very special and very, very intimate. And you guys got together last night, what, just at your house, right?
Yeah, two nights ago, we just had all the guys over. You know, my wife and I, we recently moved. You know, we think it's a cool little neighborhood, very family oriented, which is, you know, one of the reasons why we decided to move there. And, you know, as you mentioned, a huge part of what we do, like literally the most important thing, is the relationships that we build with our guys. We talk about being a family, we act like a family, and, you know, that was just another example. And, you know, I think it's what's really special to me is when you look at that photo, you know, and I have looked at it probably 10 times since that night, the photo of everybody sitting on, you know, the steps on the porch, is if you just look at everybody's smile, I mean, those are pretty genuine smiles. You know, and it's our golf family, yes, but, you know, it goes above and beyond that. Like, I want these guys to know my wife and to know my kids, and I want them to know Coach Clark's family. And, you know, everybody's kind of embraced that the whole year. Everybody's been very accepting of one another. And it's actually a lot of fun to see, you know, our guys, these 18 to 22 year olds, interact with, you know, Ansley and Graylin. You know, they're 5 years old, 3 year old girls. And then obviously we have Levi, who's a 2.5, you know, he's a boy. And then we got Luxon, 6 month old boy. You know, it's kind of interesting to see those relationships evolve. You know, you got some guys that are kind of like, I don't know what to do with a 5 year old. I don't know what to do with a newborn. And the more they're around, you know, we joke around a lot about it. We got a lot of uncles, and we got some guys that, you know, might even be ready for fatherhood in their eyes, but hopefully not yet. I don't think their mothers would want that. Not yet.
Do you ever just for fun go, hey, Ben Griffin, I know you just shot 3 rounds in the 60s in the ACC tournament, but can you change a diaper?
Yeah, we tried to get convince Will Register in an office the other night. Sadly, you know, they didn't go for it, but that would be taking it to a whole new level. They're not ready for that yet. No way.
Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I want to talk about the ACC tournament, and I want to preface it with this. I follow college golf quite a bit, and the SEC is a really good conference, but if you were to point a gun to my head from top to bottom, it's kind of a toss-up to me. I think the ACC and the Big 12 are the toughest conferences in America. I don't think you'll disagree with me, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly there are several, you know, conferences across the country that are phenomenal and are very deep and are very, very talented, and, you know, obviously we're biased, but we think highly of our own conference. And you look at what took place at Omar State Club, whatever it was, 2 weeks ago. It's just another example of that. You had 9 teams that were separated by only 13 shots. I mean, so first place to ninth place, literally just 13 shots. And, you know, Georgia Tech, who was the highest ranked team going in, they are in the victory. You know, they're obviously, the rankings will tell you they're the best team, so hats off to them. You know, but you kind of tip your hat to even a team like Notre Dame, who, you know, I haven't really looked or paid very close attention, but I would assume that they were probably the first or second team out of NCAA regionals, you know, and they were in the final group going into the last day and had a chance to win. So, yeah, it's very deep. It's very difficult to win, and it is certainly a wonderful conference for college golf.
You mentioned the scoring. Georgia Tech won the event at 29 under. Carolina finishes sixth at minus 19. And on the surface, to someone who doesn't really grasp the scoring, they go, well, shoot, that's a 10-shot win. That's blowing somebody out. In the grand scheme of things, when you're talking team golf, 10 shots, is that could just be the difference of a couple of guys getting hot and a couple of guys making bogey at the wrong time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes, definitely. It was a little bit bizarre, you know, to have 9 teams that were all in the mix. I mean, legitimately.
I mean, 9 teams separated by 13 shots is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about that, 2 weeks before that, we were out in California with a fantastic West Coast field. You know, we won by 10 shots. And now all of a sudden, there's 9 teams that are only separated by 13. You know, so it was a little bit bizarre, but at the same time, it was also exciting because, like I said, you know, with 5, 6, 7 holes to go, especially on that golf course where you know you can make a lot of birdies and there's even a lot of, you know, eagle opportunities on the way in, you really had no idea what could have happened. And yeah, legitimately, I'm sure that there are probably 6 or 7 teams that felt like they had a very good chance to win that tournament with 6 holes to play.
All in all, how did you feel about your team's performance that week? Was it just okay? Was it better than average and somebody was just better? How did you feel about it?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty average. You know, Ben played well. I don't think he would tell you that he played amazing. Obviously, he shot three rounds in the 60s, but for the most part, I thought the golf course was kind of there for the taking. We had great weather. The greens were perfect. I thought they were rolling really well. They had some speed to them. They were also very true. The fairways were relatively firm, so the golf course played short, so I thought it was there for the taking. I thought it was a pretty average week for us. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't phenomenal. We probably deserve to finish in the middle of the pack, which is where we finish.
Before we get on to previewing the regional, you brought up one name and one earlier that I wanted to hit upon, both Ben Griffin and William Register. They're about to play in their fourth straight regional, which I think is a phenomenal achievement. And Ben Griffin shooting 69 or in the 60s all three rounds of the ACC tournament. And I found this somewhat surprising, having stood there at the Finley and looked at the pictures on the wall of all the great names and golfers that everyone would recognize, that Ben Griffin is the only Tar Heel to ever shoot three rounds in the 60s at the ACC tournament. Kind of talk about those guys and their contribution to the program over the last 4 years.
Yeah, they've been enormous. They have made a ridiculously large impact on our program. And to be honest, the other night, you know, we talked about everyone kind of being at my house. It was fun and it was exciting, but at the same time, it was also sad. And you know, I spoke and the senior spoke, and I don't think anybody anticipates this or really even knows what to expect, but all of us ended up getting pretty emotional. You know, I got choked up and had a hard time getting words out. Jose was up next, and, you know, he had the same situation. You know, Ben got emotional. Will got emotional. It's hard to really put into words what exactly they mean to the program, and I'm not talking about golf right now. The golf, you can look at the numbers and the stats, and, I mean, it's insane. Those three guys currently at the moment are ranked 1, 2, and 3 in when it comes to the career scoring average in the history of Carolina golf. Maybe once every 10 years you get a guy who breaks the career scoring record. I mean, right now we got, you know, number 1, 2, and 3 on our roster. But take that aside for a second, and I think, you know, everybody got emotional because of the people that they are, the leaders that they are, the personalities that they are, and what they've meant to all of us, to the program, but to all of us just as human beings. And yes, we're absolutely going to miss the golf, but we're going to miss them as people and mentors and leaders. And it's certainly been, a fun 4 years. But it hasn't been all sunshine and roses. I mean, you know that. We talked about Ben dealing with adversity and what he did his freshman year compared to what happened his sophomore year, and how he kind of rebuilt himself and just kind of built himself back up. And, you know, William Register has had his up and downs, and Jose came in as a transfer. And, you know, we all thought he came in as actually the highest-ranked player in Wagger, and all of a sudden he couldn't even get in the lineup for the first, you know, 5 or 6 months. So there's been challenges along the way, but that's what this game is all about. That's what life is all about. And, that's why the other night was, like I said, it was fun and it was exciting, but it was also sad. So we got, 3 weeks left, hopefully, with those guys, and we expect great things to happen. And we want to make sure that we send those guys out on the highest note we possibly can.
Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina. Our guest taking Dead Aim. You're heading down to the Kissimmee Regional. You're currently ranked 17th in the nation. Other teams of note in that regional, number 5, Vanderbilt, number 8, Florida, number 20, South Florida. You can't exactly play defense on anyone at any of these regionals, and I forget how many teams are there total. I want to say it's like 12 or 15 or something, and you just have to finish in the top 5, right, Coach?
Yeah, top 5 get through. I mean, we'll go down there with the same mindset, same mentality that we have all year long, which is, we feel like if we bring our best stuff, you know, and you add them up at the end of the week, that we should have a pretty good chance of winning. And for us, we talk a lot about, you know, confidence and self-belief and the composure and the mindset and attitude that we play golf with. So we want to go down there feeling good. We want to go down there having fun. We want to go down there feeling confident. And with 9 holes to go in the tournament, we want to be in a position to win the thing.
No matter what the sport is, coaches like their teams to peak at the right time. Get you out of here on this. Do you feel like the Heels, as a squad, as a unit, as your 5 guys you're sending out there, are you peaking at the right time?
I think so. You know, the cool part is for us, we have, you know, numbers and stats and data and information to back that up. You know, since the end of the fall, or I mean, shoot, even since the middle of February, you know, our ranking is, you know, kind of skyrocketed a little bit. I think at the end of February, we were ranked 28th in the country. Like you said, we're now 17th. Before the ACC championship, we had five guys that were ranked inside the top 150, which I don't know that that's ever happened here. You know, we had five guys that had tournament scoring averages under 72, which that's never happened here. You know, so no matter what, I think as golfers, as coaches, you kind of have a feeling, right? You know where you're at. You feel good about your game. And then it's one thing to have the numbers and the data and the proof to really back it up. And I you know, that's one of the things that we said to the guys after the win at the Western. This isn't a shot at any of the teams out there. I mean, it was a phenomenal field, and, you know, Cal and Texas and Stanford, you know, but before the final round, the message to the guys in the hotel room was, yeah, cause you can look at phones and live scoring and you can get a sense. You can ask people, you know, what's going on. But my challenge to the guys was just put everything down. Like just go play. Like, I promise you, you guys are playing so well that if we just focus on us and all we do is we take care of our business, I promise you, no disrespect to anybody, we're not going to just win this tournament. We're going to crush everybody. You know, and 24 hours later, we were celebrating with a 10-shot win against some of the best teams in the country. And, you know, I feel like we still have that belief and that confidence. And, you know, we made one tweak to the lineup, and that's because Joshua Martin, who is out of the lineup at ACCs, has been at home working his tail off. And we came home, we played some rounds, and he's been unbelievable. So he'll go back in, and, you know, you and I, and well, shoot, I've talked to everybody all year long about competition. I think competition is a phenomenal thing. I think it's a healthy thing, and we're ready to go down to Florida.
Hey, good luck to the Heels. That's head men's golf coach Andrew DiBattista. I'd also like to thank Chris Rodell, writer of Arnold Palmer, Homespun Stories of the King, and John McGinnis of PGA Tour Radio and Sirius XM for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates, our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Hey, another reminder, this weekend is Mother's Day. She's the one person who never saw you hit a bad shot, only saw a ball that didn't behave and should be punished for its evil. If you're lucky enough to still have mom around, don't forget to call. And if she's no longer with us, take a moment to pause, remember, and smile. Weather-wise, maybe a little warm and sticky, but it doesn't get better than this weekend in the Carolinas. To tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts, and if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park, and Academy Sports and Outdoors.